Welcome to the Op-Ed Hour for June 11, 2026. For the Talking Information Center, this is Dan Coburn. Let's start out today talking about Donald Trump and Israel. President Trump, a second Obama? By Melanie Phillips from JNS.org. From the start of the war with Iran, it was clear that the stakes couldn't have been higher. If the United States and Israel were to succeed in neutralizing the Iranian regime, the outcome wouldn't just have been removal of a monstrous threat to Israel, the Iranian people, and the world. It also would have reshaped global politics by tearing apart the web of evil spun by Russia, China, and North Korea, at the center of which squatted the regime on which they all depended, the Islamic Republic of Iran. If, however, the United States were to lose that war and the Iranian regime remained as a threat, Russia, China, and North Korea would be galvanized by the perception that mighty America was in fact a paper tiger, and the whole free world would be placed in even greater danger. The early successes of the war, which so greatly weakened Iran, suggested that the first option was eminently possible. But now, the picture looks very different. In an article in Foreign Affairs, two pro-Islamic regime analysts, Narges Barghouti and Vasily Nasser, gloat over what they see as an Iranian victory over America. They write, "The war has given rise to a new Iran, one that will reshape the Middle East and influence the course of geopolitics for years to come." Despite the fact that this is an Iranian propaganda line, it's hard not to conclude, incredible as this may seem, that U.S. President Donald Trump is now actually dancing to the tune of Tehran. On April 8th, a ceasefire was declared between Iran and the U.S.-Israel alliance. Since then, Iran has continued to launch attacks on shipping in the Strait of Hormuz and on Gulf states. On Tuesday night, it launched drone attacks on Kuwait, killing one person and injuring more than 60. Other missiles were intercepted by U.S. and Bahraini air defenses. Since the purported ceasefire with America, Iran has used its proxy army, Hezbollah, repeatedly to attack Israeli military and civilian targets from Lebanon. Unsurprisingly, Israel has responded fiercely. On April 17th, after the Iranian regime, which was behaving like the mafia in the Strait of Hormuz, outrageously complained that Israeli retaliation against Hezbollah was preventing the strait from reopening, Trump pressured Israel into a ceasefire in Lebanon. Since that ceasefire, 14 Israel Defense Force soldiers have been killed there. No country could be expected to soft-pedal its defense in such a situation. To defeat Hezbollah, Israel needs to destroy its nerve center in the Beirut district known as Dahiya. On Monday, it was about to do so. Alarmed by this very real threat to its vital proxy, Iran threatened to walk away from negotiations with America. As a result, Trump ordered Israel not to attack Beirut and declared another ceasefire. 3 hours later, Hezbollah fired a barrage of missiles at Israel. In the early hours of Wednesday morning, a Hezbollah drone crossed into northern Israel, sending 25,000 Israelis running once more into the bomb shelters. That day, Israel and Lebanon agreed to another dubious ceasefire between the two warring sides. It is, of course, intolerable for Trump to prevent Israel from doing what it needs to do to protect its citizens against such attacks. Moreover, Trump's statements appear to fly in the face of reality. Iran is continuing to wage war against America, Israel, and their allies. Throughout it all, however, Trump continues to insist that the United States will only act in self-defense, that the ceasefire is holding, and that Iran is begging for a deal. On Wednesday, the U.S. president said talks with Iran are going very well, and that an agreement could happen this weekend. Yet Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, said no tangible progress had been made in negotiations. No surprise there. The pattern has set in of Trump making bellicose statements, Iran dangling concessions, Trump backing off, Iran repackaging those concessions as further threats and demands, Iran renewing its attacks, and America declaring that negotiations are resuming. So why is Trump apparently allowing himself to be played like a sucker, and how is Iran able to play him? After all, the regime has been gravely weakened by the war. America's naval blockade is having a devastating effect on the Iranian economy, with a 90% drop in exports, oil production slashed in half, and electricity supplies severely restricted. The answer is that Trump is in a trap of his own making, stemming from two fundamental and related mistakes. He thinks he can negotiate the end of the war. The first rule of negotiation, however, is to do so from a position of strength. Trump could have used Israel as leverage to weaken Iran by crippling Hezbollah. Instead, by holding Israel back from delivering the decisive blow against Iran's proxy army, he has enabled Iran to use Hezbollah as leverage against Israel. He has thus weakened his negotiating position. That's because he thinks his strategy is a winning one. He thinks that when his blockade of Iranian shipping really starts to bite and Iran runs out of money and food, the regime will start to negotiate seriously to avoid the country being totally destroyed. But the Tehran regime is run by fanatics who will sacrifice the people, the economy, and the country in accordance with their belief that the Shia Messiah will be brought to earth through an apocalypse. Trump thinks every problem can be solved by a deal that only he has the skill to pull off. He doesn't seem to grasp that some agendas are so uncompromising that they are simply non-negotiable. Trump's insistence on a deal has given Tehran the scent of victory in its nostrils. For the regime, a deal represents the surrender of America. Every negotiation is viewed as a sign of American weakness and a spur to redouble its attacks. For the regime, the purpose of these negotiations is not to get the best deal possible for Iran. It's to force America to surrender. America's apparent failure to grasp this is potentially tragic. The U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has said the regime is now willing to discuss parts of its nuclear program that it previously refused to negotiate, signaling potential movement in the talks. But any deal will be worthless. The Iranian regime is a world-class cheater that has never kept to the terms of any deal it's ever made, never observed any ceasefire, telling lies reflexively in accordance with the Islamic Republic of Taqiyya, which makes it mandatory to lie in the cause of Islam. In any event, what exactly is there to negotiate if Trump's terms are, as they purport to be, the unconditional surrender of Iran? Behind Trump's strategic errors, however, lies a more profound and profoundly worrying issue. The Iran war is deeply unpopular with the American people. In part, that's because Trump has never made the case to them that it's being waged because Iran poses a mortal threat to America itself. But mostly it's because American humiliation in Iraq, and before that Vietnam, along with decades of anti-Western propaganda in American schools and universities, has now made Americans viscerally averse to boots on the ground anywhere and any U.S. troops being placed in danger. A culture that no longer accepts the need for sacrifice in the cause of a just war is a culture that has no future. That's the desperate situation now of Britain and Western Europe. America is in danger of going the same way. What started as the United States finally grasping that it had no option but to neutralize Iran because it was getting perilously close to obtaining nuclear weapons to hit the great Satan, now threatens to turn into a repeat of the 2015 nuclear deal debacle. That was when Iran used bait-and-switch tactics until the Obama administration surrendered America's security to fanatics who would eventually get the bomb. President Trump is now at serious risk of turning into a second Obama. Not just Israel, but also the entire free world should be alarmed. Trump's mixed messages cannot obscure his record on confronting Iran. By David M. Weinberg from J. Post. It is maddening to be handcuffed by the U.S. president when fighting Hezbollah, especially when Israeli soldiers and civilians are falling like flies to the terrorist army's drones and rockets. It is exasperating to hear U.S. President Donald Trump talk one day about bombing Iran's nuclear and energy sites to kingdom come and crushing the regime of the evil Ayatollahs, and the next to hear him talk about very nice and responsible leaders in Iran that he would like to meet, and to learn that Trump may shower these leaders with tens of billions of dollars in freed cash and sanctions relief. It is frustrating to recognize that after all the effort and expense of the past year to strip Iran of its hegemonic ambitions and threatening abilities, Trump may set a ceiling on this war, not by the cusp of Iran's remaining offensive capabilities, but by his own imperfect endurance. It is vexing to accept Trump's truancy, the peril of his non-ideological approach to foreign and defense affairs, his too transactional thinking, his non-dogmatic methodology for solving conflicts, refreshing in some contexts, but dangerously delusional in others. It is irritating that Trump ridiculously believes the force of his personality can fix everything and lead to swift and huge peace deals everywhere. This is true regarding his pie-in-the-sky plans for grand civilizational peace in Gaza, as well as his blathering about reaching a 10th accord of peace globally with Tehran. It is infuriating when Trump praises the Israeli Prime Minister one day as a great wartime leader and friend, then publicly calls him expletive deleted, crazy, and asserts that Netanyahu is in his back pocket. He'll do whatever I want him to do. Worse still, Trump gallingly asserts that if there wasn't me, there would be no Israel, and that Netanyahu would be in prison if it weren't for me. Those avowals about Israel's destiny and Netanyahu's durability are not remotely true. They are unacceptable. It is right and righteous to push back against Trump when he crosses the line from outlandish swagger and inflated vainglory, which is his style, like it or lump it, to insulting and damaging aspersions that have life and death consequences for Israel. After having said all that, we have to get past Trump's annoying approach to people and politics and consider his rock-solid policymaking record and commitments on the issues most important to Israel. In particular, the U.S. president must be lauded for the nobility of his resistance to Iran, and I believe his intention to see the job through to completion. President Trump understands that stopping the war now amid some short-term economic discomfort would be a victory for the mullahs. Iran cannot be allowed to conclude that shutting down oil flows is its passport to survival, now or in the future. After all, the spike in oil prices due to traffic stoppage in the Strait of Hormuz was not unexpected. As Trump himself has said, the disruption is a small price to pay for major security advances. It also makes no sense to leave so many loose ends in Iran, from missiles and production facilities to nuclear sites at Pickaxe Mountain and Isfahan tunnels, where Iran's gigantic stockpile of highly enriched uranium for nuclear bomb-making is said to be stored. This is why massive U.S. air, naval, and amphibious forces are still in the region. And Trump recognizes that the current conflict is essentially a world war against America's greatest strategic adversaries, including China and Russia, who are allied with Iran. Therefore, Trump is exceedingly unlikely to desert the battlefield without more significantly quelling Iran. He will not just declare a synthetic victory and withdraw his troops. He may wait a while for a range of reasons, from upcoming July 4th celebrations, America's 250th, to midterm elections in November, to a necessary restocking of American armaments. But I'm betting that he will further pursue the military effort to extinguish the threat of the Ayatollahs to Gulf Arab countries, to Israel, and to the Western world. So why the obfuscation in Trump's many statements? Why the fetters on Israel's necessary wars with Iran's proxy armies that are camped along the country's borders? Why the dissing of Netanyahu? Well, the administration's ambiguity confuses the enemy. If we are left guessing at Trump's next moves, so are the Ayatollahs. But Trump himself? I do not think that he is at all confused regarding Iran. From his 2018 dumping of Obama's rotten nuclear deal with Iran to his 2020 assassination of the IRGC chief Qasem Soleimani to Operation Midnight Hammer last June to Operation Epic Fury this year, Trump has proven neither fickle nor flighty. On the contrary, Trump has broadcast unwavering willpower and purpose. He ain't a paragon of virtue in so many other ways, but Trump has shown profound understanding of his responsibility to reshape the regional and global strategic architecture by eviscerating Iran. He also has evinced domestic political courage in this regard, taking on hard left Marxist and pro-Islamic critics and hard right isolationist and Christian nationalist critics. He has taken risks with his own MAGA base by slapping down the loudest and most influential foul-mouthed fault-finders like Tucker Carlson. Remember, despite the rise of an enemy potentially as lethal as Nazi Germany, many Western leaders nevertheless have preferred accommodation with Iran. It is always easier to delay and deflect than to fight a fiercely committed and skilled enemy. And yet, Trump has taken on the Iranian challenge. In defiance of conventional wisdom that the responsible approach is to swallow Iran's piecemeal provocations to avoid war, and that Iran's hegemonic ambitions are anyway nearly unstoppable, Trump preferred to draw blood and a red line. He defied the Ayatollahs instead of dancing with them. And so, Trump ought to be recognized and appreciated for his moral and strategic clarity. This war is an act of rectitude, of justice, and sanity in global security affairs. So, if you want to worry that Trump could yet cut a bad deal with Tehran, an agreement that does not push Iran far enough away from the nuclear bomb and from Israel's borders, or that he may stop short of regime change, go ahead and stew. But for the moment, Trump should still be acclaimed for his continued resistance to Iran, including his long blockade of Hormuz. Yes, Trump's dithering is dangerous. His specious slamming of Netanyahu is unsettling. Israel's existence is not a favor bestowed by Washington, and Israel's leaders cannot accept every security policy dictate from D.C. But working with Trump over the next 31 months to more decisively complete the campaign against Iran, uncomfortably bobbing and weaving as necessary, remains the right and necessary exigency. Now let's turn to some domestic politics and Senate candidate from Maine, Graham Plattner. Mixed feelings about Plattner? Fine. But he needs to win. Case closed. By Michael Tomasky from The New Republic. I'm guessing you have a pretty good idea of what Graham Plattner was getting up to last week, fending off yet another round of allegations about his character. But what about Susan Collins, Maine's incumbent GOP senator and the person almost sure to be Plattner's opponent this November? You probably didn't hear a word about her. The only significant news story of the week in which she figured, aside from being mentioned in all the Plattner stories, is that she cast her 10,000th consecutive vote in the Senate. A milestone, to be sure, but something of a double-edged one, as it serves to remind voters that she's been in the Senate since Christ left Chicago. This is just how Collins wants things. As long as the subject is Plattner's boozing and his ex-girlfriends, Collins may skate to re-election. So the key thing Plattner has to do, assuming he wins tomorrow's primary and stays in the race, is to maneuver things such that come October, the topic is Collins' record, not his past. We'll get to that record in a bit, but first let's deal with Plattner, the Plattner question. Two big stories came out last week. The first was about his sexting with several women in the early days of his current marriage. He married Amy Gertner in 2023. Early in the campaign, Gertner told an aide who was a friend about the messages, and the friend, now presumably an ex-friend, told a lot of people and shared some screen grabs with the New York Times. Gertner denounced the friend, Genevieve McDonald, and defended her husband and marriage. On that one, I think your average person would say, well, if his wife doesn't care, why should I? The second story was potentially more damaging and concerned Plattner allegedly twisting the arm of a former girlfriend and slamming a door shut on her. Also, that he regularly grabbed her by the shoulders, according to the New York Times, which broke the story last Thursday. It's disturbing, no doubt. It's worth noting that this woman is, or was at the time, apparently a very committed conservative Republican, the co-founder of Ladies for Kavanaugh, which she formed to confront what she termed the baseless 11th-hour accusations orchestrated to stop the justice's confirmation. One question the Times left on the table, but that crossed my mind and maybe yours, was how Plattner could have said, "You are literally everything to me," to someone who, according to Newsweek, worked at the Heritage Foundation at the time. Two other exes told the Times of similar treatment from Plattner. On the other hand, several other exes, Dude Got Around, described him as a fun and caring partner, and some remain friends with him to this day. Plattner denies all the physical stuff, so someone is lying. Personally, I don't know what to make of this guy. I suspect he's not telling the truth about his Nazi tattoo, and I bet you that he knew what it meant. But I also don't think that makes him a Nazi. He has obviously lived a life that we would at the very least call picturesque. Balzac would have had fun with him. There's also the question of, as it is often said in politics, what else is out there? Any good campaign, and Susan Collins does run good campaigns, knows to sit on the really bad stuff until after Labor Day, although campaigns can't always control when things are disclosed. And anyway, all the revelations about Plattner seem to be coming from establishment Democrats who are unnerved by his lefty swagger. There's a lot we don't know, and a chance we'll find out all about it. I do, however, know these two things. One, Plattner is almost certain to be the Democratic nominee. Two, short of revelations involving murder, rape, or a taste for child pornography, Plattner needs to be backed by Democrats to the hilt. That may seem like a really low bar, and maybe it is, but I'm less interested in his personal life than I am in Collins' public one, because that's what really matters here. So let us now return to the question of Collins' week. The Senate cast a bunch of votes last week, and Collins did what she always does when she's up for re-election. She voted with Democrats on the ones people pay attention to, and as a Republican on the others. there were a number of votes related to Donald Trump's $1.8 billion slush fund. On most of those, like this one, for example, she was one of maybe two or three Republicans, with Tom Tillis and Bill Cassidy, who are both retiring, voting with the Democrats. On other, less highly visible matters, though, she went with her party and with Trump. Last Wednesday, the Senate rejected a resolution that would have overturned Trump's rollback of Biden-era emissions standards for coal and oil-fired power. She went party line on that one. The day before, she voted to confirm a federal judge for Kansas, who at his confirmation hearing refused to say that Trump lost the 2020 election. Ah, judges. That brings us to where Plattner needs to direct attention in this campaign. Maine voters need to be reminded, to the tune of about $40 million worth of TV commercials, of Collins' support for putting Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. "He has been an exemplary public servant," she said at the time. She hoped that Kavanaugh would be a unifying force on the court. Right. And most infamously, she's accepted his assurances that he saw Roe v. Wade as settled law. She was either lying about that or was the only person in America stupid enough to believe him. Plattner should ask her, repeatedly, which it was. Different voting studies place Collins' record of supporting Trump's initiatives at anywhere from 70% to 95%. Whichever the true figure, there's bound to be material there. Plattner needs this race to be about that voting record and all the stands for working-class Mainers that Collins hasn't taken. "I may have done some bad things," Plattner might say, "but one thing I haven't done is spend the last 40 years helping pick the pockets of working-class people and transfer trillions of dollars to the very rich." Collins has voted in favor of virtually every GOP tax cut bill over her career. If Plattner has Mainers thinking about that in October, and barring truly disqualifying new revelations, he can win. And the Democratic Party needs to stop submarining him. Imperfect as he is, there's a reason his campaign caught fire. Democrats ought to try to learn from that, not squirm away from it. Graham Plattner and the New Wave Left Detest Western Exceptionalism, by Julian Epstein from the New York Post. How many scandals can beset a major party Senate candidate before the party jettisons him or her? How extreme can such a candidate become before he or she is dumped? If you're part of the Democratic Party apparatus in Maine, the answer seems to be that nothing is too extreme. Nothing is too scandalous. By this point, everyone has heard the sordid stories of Graham Plattner. The allegations that he twisted an ex's arm and yanked her out of a cab by her wrist after an argument, he has denied this. The admittance of sexting women shortly after getting married, the mocking of Purple Heart recipients, calling Army soldiers fat, lazy trash, and seemingly wishing their death, slandering rural Americans as racist and stupid, and blacks because they don't tip. The Portageon masturbation cringe musings, and much more. Candidate Plattner writes off all these personal misgivings as trivial foibles and says it's his politics that count. The mindless groupthink Democrats fall right into line. "Maybe we focus on the issues facing the American people," squirmed his patron saint, Senator Bernie Sanders. But the real obscenity of Graham Plattner is not his personal misdeeds. Rather, it's his politics. He has openly embraced communism, which slaughtered 100 million people in the 20th century while oppressing and impoverishing many more. He sported a tattoo like the ones worn by Hitler's SS at death camps that killed 6 million Jews in the Holocaust. Sleepwalking Democrats have leveled charges of fascism so habitually in such zombie-like fashion they don't even recognize real Nazism when in their midst. In short, Plattner is part of the new wave left, making common cause with extremists, socialists, and Islamists. It sports an empty form of political narcissism, the con job of a Robin Hood movement pretending to rescue us from fake oppression scenarios. This so it can moralize its way into office on a platform of failed ideas that build nothing other than race and class resentments and government dependency, the substance of civilizational failure. This new left seems to detest Western exceptionalism, an exceptionalism that has enriched and liberated billions of people more than any civilization ever. Even our poorest today are wealthier than over 90% of the rest of the world. Graham Platner would have been dismissed as unacceptable in the Democratic Party just a decade ago. So what does his embrace tell us about modern-day Democrats and where they're headed? This tells us that the party has a weak bench. It's no secret that working-class voters, the core base for Democrats since the New Deal, are abandoning Democrats, as are other groups. 7 in 10 voters think the party is too extreme and out of touch. To rebuild, the party could go back to the center or lunge to the socialist left, led by its activist class. It's choosing the latter. But very few on the socialist left have ever built a business, or anything else for that matter. AOC was a bartender before her election to Congress in 2018. Bernie Sanders is a career politician, suckling on the taxpayer teat nearly all his career. To paraphrase Thomas Sowell, the far left knows nothing about creating prosperity. Its leaders just think that it somehow exists and that the only interesting question is how to redistribute it. This means the New Wave Democrat movement doesn't really know much about building through discovery, innovation, and growth, the hard stuff that grows the economic pie and secures our future. Many on the left are like Nepo babies, knowing only how to take from the government payrolls, government-funded NGOs, and George Soros-like ideological philanthropy. First, this is why the new breed Democratic bench will be a thinner one, attracting novices, activists, and extremists like the terrorist linked Adam Hamavi, who won the Democratic nomination in New Jersey with the backing of Democratic socialists in Congress. This toxicity will deter more serious candidates. Second, the Platner conundrum also tells us that this new wave Democrat is myopic. Democrats across the country will be badgered all fall with questions about supporting the Nazi-tattooed, Hamas-supporting, self-described communist. When they try to dodge, as Senator Chris Murphy clumsily did last Sunday, they will be seen as weak, cowardly, and out of touch by normie voters. Third, Platner conveys that Democrats are situational, insincere moralists whose collective heads explode at every one of Trump's transgressions, but who stared at their shoelaces when it came to one of their own. Finally, the Platner phenomenon tells us of the cowardice of the party's moderates. When I worked years ago at the House Judiciary Committee alongside Senator Schumer, then a proud centrist, he would always talk about the importance of saying no to the hard left. Who would have thought that years later he would be so intimidated by his online activists that he would coddle a candidate cheering the genocidal Hamas today? Ultimately, it is this cowardice of party leaders who know better that is leading to the party's decadent decline. Now let's take a look at some thoughts on climate change. Scientists ditched a scary climate scenario. Now what? By Brad Plummer and Eric Nyler from the New York Times. It's rare for technical papers about climate modeling to kick off a heated public debate or attract attention from the White House. But that's what's happening recently after an international team of researchers published a major revision of the emissions scenarios used to study global warming. When scientists try to model how hot Earth could get this century, they typically look at a range of possibilities for how much planet-warming pollution humans might pump into the atmosphere. These scenarios get updated every 7 years or so. In this latest update, the researchers abandoned a dire and often criticized high-emission scenario known as RCP 8.5 that has been prominently cited in thousands of climate studies over the past decade. The authors said the scenario was now implausible given recent energy trends. That provoked online arguments among scientists. For years, critics of the high-emission scenario had argued that it was always unrealistic, in part because it envisioned that countries would burn coal at absurdly high rates. They argued that any studies or news reports relying on that scenario exaggerated the risks of climate change. Why, those critics now asked, did the course correction take so long? Other researchers, however, noted that scientists still can't rule out extreme warming, even if the odds might be low, and that there are good scientific reasons for studying high emissions scenarios. Recently, President Trump weighed in, suggesting that the revision showed that global warming wasn't a threat, and the United Nations top climate committee just admitted that its own projections, RCP 8.5, were wrong. Wrong, wrong. The majority of climate scientists still say global warming is a serious problem, and that even more plausible medium emissions scenarios can carry grave dangers. But the new paper has raised questions about whether some of the risks of climate change have been poorly communicated or overstated in years past, and how best to think about those risks going forward. How much hotter the world will get depends on two big factors: how many greenhouse gases humans will emit by burning fossil fuels and cutting down forests, and how the Earth's climate will physically respond. Predicting emissions over the next century is extremely difficult, since so much depends on future economic growth and technological changes. So scientists try to consider a wide range of possibilities. In the early 2010s, climate scientists created a suite of standardized low, medium, and high emissions pathways. The goal, they said, was to capture every plausible outcome, even unlikely ones. The highest one, RCP 8.5, envisioned annual carbon dioxide emissions roughly tripling this century. All the scenarios, once fed into complex computer models of Earth's climate, project significant future warming, leading to increased heat waves, sea level rise, wildfires, droughts, and other changes. Yet RCP 8.5, the high emissions scenario, leads to the most dire outcomes by far. It envisions Earth's average temperature rising somewhere around 4.4 degrees Celsius or 8 degrees Fahrenheit by 2100, compared to pre-industrial levels. By contrast, under RCP 4.5, an intermediate scenario, models suggest Earth would warm roughly 2.7 degrees Celsius. That's a big difference, since every degree brings substantially more severe effects. Some studies have found that under RCP 8.5, large swaths of the planet might regularly experience days hotter than the human body can tolerate. The risks of catastrophic tipping points, such as widespread rainforest die-offs or the disintegration of polar ice sheets, are also far greater. But there has long been confusion about what RCP 8.5 represented and how it should be used. The high emissions pathway wasn't meant to be a prediction, but more of a worst case, said Detlef van Vuren, a climate scientist at Utrecht University and a leading figure in scenario development. It's simply exploring what happens if we end up with much higher emissions than we expect. Many scientists find it useful to probe such hypotheticals. Climate models often struggle to capture dynamics like whether ice sheets might collapse with moderate warming, even though this is an extraordinarily important question for the real world. So scientists will often use a high-emission scenario and models to establish an upper bound for, say, how much sea levels might rise. A lot of climate research is about understanding how Earth's climate system behaves under certain conditions, rather than a statement about what's most likely to happen in the future, said Robert Kopp, a climate scientist at Rutgers University. They're both important, but those are two different questions. That distinction, however, has often been lost. Many scientific studies have wrongly referred to RCP 8.5 as business-as-usual scenario, suggesting that this was the pathway humanity is currently headed for. News stories about climate research often emphasize results based on RCP 8.5 as a picture of what the world can expect unless countries slash their emissions, which isn't right either. In one study in Science, for example, looked at how rising temperatures could cause lower agricultural yields or heat deaths in the United States, hurting the economy. While that study explored numerous harmful scenarios, the highest estimated damages based on RCP 8.5 were a big focus and got more attention, including in the New York Times. Many other climate stories have been more careful, highlighting how more plausible medium emission scenarios could affect, say, extreme heat or flooding. Some scientists soon began questioning what they saw as a disproportionate focus on the high emissions scenario. In 2017, a study by Justin Ritchie and Hadi Dawaladbadi pointed out that RCP 8.5 envisioned a five-fold expansion in the global coal use, including fueling cars with coal-based liquids, which they explained was exceptionally unlikely. Another paper in Nature in 2020 argued that the recent global energy trends, including the falling cost of renewable energy, made the high emissions pathway increasingly implausible, and that the medium emissions pathway seemed much likelier. The authors warned that RCP 8.5 should not be cited as business as usual. Yet many policymakers and researchers continued to emphasize the high emissions scenario for years afterward, said Roger Pilkey, Jr., a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a leading critic of the use of RCP 8.5. Central banks used it to test whether financial institutions are prepared for the effects of climate change. Governments often use it for adaptation planning, and insurance companies use it to set rates. We've known for a decade that this scenario is implausible and that the community got off on a bad track very early on when the scenario set was created, Dr. Pilkey said. If the past 15 years of climate messaging had been based on a more realistic scenario, he added, it wouldn't make climate change go away, but it would certainly make climate change look far less apocalyptic. It would look more like a significant risk with serious consequences. Many on the political right, including Trump administration officials, have cited the misuse of RCP 8.5 as a reason to dismiss climate science as overly alarmist. Matthew Burgess, an environmental economist at the University of Wyoming, said that scientists, in turn, were often overly defensive about the issue, which fed into polarization. Some scientists now say the scenario was often badly communicated. RCP 8.5 was never meant to be a business-as-usual scenario, but that point often got lost as it was used by more and more people, said Jewery Rojli, a climate scientist at Imperial College London. The new emissions scenarios published last month are an attempt to create better inputs for the next generation of climate models. The authors said they discarded the RCP 8.5 scenario because it had become implausible, thanks to actions countries have taken to tackle climate change. Some experts dispute that rationale, saying that RCP 8.5 was never plausible. while authors do propose new high emission scenarios, they could lead to similarly high estimated levels of warming later in the 22nd century. They've added a warning that these are not business as usual pathways. The researchers also discarded some very low emission scenarios because nations are unlikely to slash their fossil fuel use as deeply as many world leaders had urged. In effect, the scenarios are becoming less pessimistic, but also less optimistic. In addition, the researchers included a medium emissions outlook that is explicitly meant to reflect current government policies. That scenario leads to roughly 2.5 to 3 degrees Celsius of global warming by 2100, compared to pre-industrial levels. That's lower than the temperature forecasts from the old RCP 8.5 scenario, but experts warn that even moderate levels of warming can pose significant dangers. For more than a decade, world leaders have pledged to keep warming well below 2 degrees Celsius to avoid what they deemed unacceptable risks. The planet has already warmed roughly 1.3 degrees since pre-industrial times. It's good news that we can drop the highest emission scenario, said Dr. Rogeli, but the other side is that we're also finding that the risks for lower levels of warming are often worse than we thought. For example, at 2 degrees Celsius of warming, the world could lose most of its coral reefs, and an additional 410 million people in urban areas could face water scarcity because of severe drought, according to a recent UN climate assessment. At 3 degrees, global flood damages could increase threefold without adaptation, while more than one quarter of known plant and animal species on land could face a high risk of extinction. There is also still plenty of uncertainty around exactly how much Earth will heat from a given level of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. That means the world could still get even hotter than the models project, even if the particular assumptions about coal burning in RCP 8.5 don't come to pass. There is how all the various feedbacks in the climate system, like clouds, snow, ice cover, and water vapor in the atmosphere, respond to warming, said Dr. Hausfather, a climate scientist at Berkeley Earth. If you put all those together, you really get a pretty wide range of possible outcomes this century, even under a medium emissions scenario. Despite the new scenarios, it's not feasible for scientists to quickly go back and redo older studies, experts said, since the complex computer climate models that simulate Earth's atmosphere and oceans take months to run. But researchers say it would be imprudent to dismiss all past studies that looked at RCP 8.5. Many climate risks scale linearly with temperature, so that research can still provide insights into a lower emissions world. Some recent work also suggests that even medium emissions scenarios can lead to extreme impacts, such as severe droughts in flood-producing regions that were previously thought only to occur in high emissions scenarios. If you're working on local adaptation and trying to figure out how high to build a seawall, you certainly want to consider what the worst that can happen is, said Madison Condon, an associate professor of law at Boston University who works on climate adaptation. The climate scam is acknowledged. Americans were fed lies and deserve to be compensated. By Gary Abernathy from the Empowerment Alliance. Before apparently backing off the idea this week, the U.S. Department of Justice had announced the creation of an anti-weaponization fund to provide a systematic process to hear and redress claims of others who suffered weaponization and lawfare from the government. While the original idea for such a fund might have been on shaky ground, with criticism coming from both parties, establishing a way to compensate Americans who were victims of the weaponization of the Obama and Biden administration's energy policies would be entirely legitimate. the time is ripe for a serious accounting of the harm done to Americans by climate hysteria, considering how many mea culpas are now emerging. The latest to line up with at least some nod to the truth and accuracy is the New York Times, the leading mainstream media proponent of climate change nonsense. The Times last week produced a story headlined, "Why Scientists Retired, the Dire Climate Scenario Used for Over a Decade." The story reported that an international team of researchers has abandoned a dire and often criticized high-emission scenario known as RCP 8.5 that has been prominently cited in thousands of climate studies over the last decade. The authors said this scenario was now implausible given recent energy trends. The story went on to acknowledge that the new paper has raised questions about whether some of the risks of climate change have been poorly communicated or overstated in years past and how best to think about those risks going forward. In other words, the climate deniers, as the far-left media derisively describes anyone who has questioned the outlandishly dire gloom and doom climate scenarios, have turned out to be right. Of course, the New York Times being the New York Times, it was still necessary to claim that the majority of climate scientists still say global warming is a serious problem, and that even more plausible, medium emission scenarios can carry grave dangers, and that some true believers are claiming that the revised, less panicky outlook is because the fight against fossil fuels has been so effective. Sure. But in between the occasional "we should still be a little nervous" qualifiers, the lengthy New York Times piece contained numerous stunning confessions, both in regard to the climate cult movement in general and the newspaper specifically. For instance, for years, critics of the high-emission scenario had argued that it was always unrealistic, in part because it envisioned that countries would burn coal at absurdly high rates. No kidding. Predicting emissions over the next century is difficult, since so much depends on future economic growth and technological changes, just like so many of us have been saying or screaming for years. The high emissions pathway wasn't meant to be a prediction, but more of a worst case. That's not the way it was sold. The news stories about climate research often emphasize results based on RCP 8.5 as a picture of what the world can expect unless countries slash their emissions, which isn't right either. Oh, now you tell us. The highest estimated damages based on RCP 8.5 were a big focus and got more attention, including in the New York Times. That was not by design. The story goes on to note examples of scientists urging caution, but many policymakers and researchers continued to emphasize the high emission scenario for years afterward, as one think tank critic said. The story quotes several people who now say that the worst case scenario was not intended to be presented as realistic. And yet it was. It was used to demand radical changes, to set unrealistic targets for transitioning from fossil fuels to alternatives, to throw billions in tax dollars into subsidies for solar and wind in the name of saving the planet, while strangling the life out of the most affordable, reliable, and effective energy sources available, to shame anyone doubting the logic and the predicted severity of man-made climate change. The authors of the new study are now presenting revised predictions that imagine worst-case scenarios that would lead to similarly high estimated levels of warming later in the 22nd century, but they've added a warning that these are not business-as-usual pathways. Read that carefully. The worst-case scenarios could lead to dangerous warming levels later in the 22nd century. Not 12 years from now, as Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, and others have warned. Not 30 years from now, not in our lifetimes or the lifetimes of most of our children or grandchildren. And even that prediction is unlikely to happen, they admit. But saying, "I told you so," is not enough. The admission that we have been lied to over and over and cannot be the end of it. They used to say in the old days, "We demand satisfaction, and citizens deserve it." It's now time for a reckoning. After years of lectures from government leaders, especially during the Obama and Biden administrations, insisting we needed to spend billions of dollars to fight the big bad climate boogeyman, we must insist on three things. First, the money directed toward far-left climate-related mandates and projects, EV mandates, carbon penalties and fees, hundreds of thousands of acres of solar panels replacing cropland, no more gas appliances, must immediately be halted. Second, damages to the American people who fell for the worst-case global warming scenarios or were forced by federal or state government to change their energy-related lifestyles are entirely warranted. Finally, as often stated here, enacting the Affordable, Reliable, Clean Energy Security Act, ARC-ES, either by congressional action or White House executive order, would ensure that the disastrous initiatives undertaken in the throes of climate hysteria can never be repeated. Americans deserve to be reassured that we will never go down that path again. Well, that's all the time I have for today. You've been listening to the Op-Ed Hour for the Talking Information Center. This is Dan Cobrin. Have a great rest of your day.